How are you, sir?
This is Pierre.
Oh.
I can't believe I'm talking to you, Dr. A the Great.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I love listening to you. You have a personality just like my father.
I don't think you should feel helpless. You are helpless.
Doctor, I really appreciate that. That makes me feel a lot better.
You be at peace, or else I'm going to yell at you.
Trying to find a reason to speak to you. I think you're the best thing since sliced bread.
That Ray, he's something.
Thank you so much for what you're doing for all the parents out there.
They don't know what I can possibly do.
I don't either.
I'm getting my money worth, I think, at this phone call.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
I was asked, are some things better left unsaid? Yes, I believe that's true. And I in fact, usually think that after I've said it. Nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In. People will ask me, Dr. Ray, do you ever get anxious? I go, well, the first time I did, I was two. I was very anxious because I realized that in just 1 year, I had double my age. And I thought, if I keep going like this, by the time I'm six, I'll be 90. Some might say I'm six. Nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In. Of course, this is E-Person Monday. Eric Dumont, my board operator and man there in Ann Arbor, which is the co-producer along with EWTN, Global Catholic Radio Network. Unfortunately for me, some 14 years ago, I approached EWTN with an idea for a TV show, and they accepted it. I don't know if they're regretting it ever since. Living Right with Dr. Ray. We were just finished up our 13th season, ready to roll, all brand new stuff. Sometimes people say, when are you getting new stuff? I got new stuff. It's coming up. And we're also doing season 14. We are scheduled to be in North Dakota. Yeah, Real Presence Radio Group. That folks, I'll tell you what, if their banquets, their pledge support banquets, are any indication of the kind of support that they get, we are going to have a packed house when we do those shows. They're going to be in October, so we'll get a chance to do that. And then also heading down to Washington, D.C., which we know that Guadalupe Radio has an affiliate down there, Divine Mercy College. So that's where we're scheduled to go, and we've talking with some other folks about this. So thanks for joining me. This is C.S. Lewis. Now, C.S. Lewis is, safe to say, the highest profile 20th century apologist for the Christian faith. Very, very much so. He says this: of course I pray for the dead. The action is so spontaneous, so all but inevitable, that only the most compulsive theological case against it would deter me. And I hardly know how the rest of my prayers would survive if those for the dead were forbidden. What? He goes on. At our age, and this was when he was older, the majority of those we love best are dead. What sort of intercourse with God could I have if what I love best were unmentionable to him? I believe in purgatory. C.S. Lewis, in Mere Christianity. He goes on. Our souls demand purgatory, don't they? Would it not break the heart if God said to us, it is true, my son, that your breath smells and your rags drip with mud and slime. But we are charitable here. And no one will upbraid you with these things, nor draw away from you. Enter into the joy. Should we not reply, with submission, sir, and if there is no objection, I'd rather be cleaned first. It may hurt, you know. Even so, sir, I assume, this is C.S. Lewis now, that the process of purification will normally involve suffering. Partly from tradition, partly because most real good that has been done me in this life has involved it. My favorite image on this matter comes from the dentist's chair. I hope that when the tooth of life is drawn, and I'm coming around, a voice will say, rinse your mouth out with this. This will be purgatory. The rinsing may take longer than I can now imagine. The taste of it may be more fiery and astringent than my present sensibility could endure. So there you have it. C.S. Lewis makes a rational case for purgatory. The Catholics can make a biblical case because of the books in the Old Testament that are in our Bible that were removed by Martin Luther in the 15th century. 16th. Also, there's a tradition, the Martyr's Kiddush, the Jewish people called it. It was an 11-month period of pray for the dead, that they might be loosed from the chains, as the Old Testament says. Jesus never spoke against it. Jesus never said, hey, whoa, 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 this is not necessary here. It's not necessary. Dr. A, Jesus said, this day you shall be with me in paradise. End of story. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200 straight to heaven. Yes, but after death, time ceases to exist. So therefore, it doesn't really matter. He's saying this day, meaning this earth day, of course. But afterwards, what is the purification? Is it brief and intense in our time frame? But we don't really know what time is like in eternity, right? It ceases to exist. It's eternity. There's no time. There's no change. Time is a measurement of change. So that remark is irrelevant to speak against purgatory. It would also make logical sense, would it not? Scripture says, nothing impure shall enter heaven. That's in Revelation. Nothing with sin shall enter heaven. Well, how's that going to happen? Unless there is some type of purification. All I know is I don't know an awful lot about me. I don't know really the way that I fall short in every way. I don't know that. I could spend my life scrutinizing my sinfulness, but I don't know what I don't know. That's why I got a wife to tell me. But somehow, some way, if I want to be free of all that self stuff that clings to me, somehow, some way, I got to see it. I got to know it. And then I got to shed it by God's grace. Purgatory makes logical sense. Certainly has historical evidence to it. It's got biblical evidence to it. And the greatest Protestant apologist of the 20th century said, there's plenty of evidence to believe in it. Dr. A, thanks for joining me.
Don't touch that dial. Dr. A will be back.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. a golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
The history books tell of many times and places in which the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, decided that for the good of the state, some element of its population should be killed, like the Irish or African slaves or Jews or priests. While the Christian tradition maintains that human life is sacred, don't assume that the world agrees. Accordingly, many of the mothers, fathers, and grandparents bringing an unborn child to the abortuary know that they are killing a human being, yet have no problem with it, because history has taught them that human life is not sacred, and that occasionally certain members of society have to be sacrificed. Therefore, the pro-life movement cannot argue simply that human life is sacred. It must argue why it is sacred. The pro-life movement should show the world that as the person struggles with loneliness, runs from death, seeks answers, seeks beauty, the person is showing that he belongs to God. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
This week on Christ is the Answer, we continue Father John's teaching series on the Ten Commandments. After freeing the Hebrew people from slavery in Egypt, the Lord gave Moses a new rule to which the people would abide as part of the new covenant. The most recognizable of these rules are the Ten Commandments. Join us this week as Father John expounds on the 7th, 8th, and 10th Commandments, asking the question, why be good? Tune in for Christ is the Answer, Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Dr. Ray Guarendi program, Doctor is in, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Website, drray.com, drray.com. All 18 books are there with descriptions to see if any of those might be helpful to you. And if you don't want to buy a whole book, you can buy a couple of pages at a time, you know, but I decide which pages you get. I mean, you may get just a contents page, that's it, taking your chance. I once heard a guy on TV climbed Mount Everest. They asked him why. He said, because it was there. I remember thinking that one reason for one of the most challenging feats in our existence should be different than the reason I ate an entire half gallon of ice cream. Because it was there. So he climbs Everest because it was there, and I ate a half gallon of ice cream because it was there. I feel a camaraderie with him. I really do. Okie dokie, let's see where we're going. This is from a dear lady. I met her in St. Louis, Dr. K. Wonderful lady. She listens regularly, and she offers incredible insights that I use all the time, sometimes giving her credit for them even. Holy cow, Dr. Ray. How do we know hows are holy? Where did that come from? I was caught off guard by a conversation with my former priest where he said to me, now do the math here. We have 300 families and individual communicants. If everyone was on welfare, collecting only $10,000 each year, and tithed, we would have $300,000 per year. It would cover our budget with a surplus. Now, one might say yes, but $1,000 to somebody bringing in only $10,000 is a heavy, heavy bite. That it is. That's the interesting thing about tithing. I think, first of all, if all Catholics tithed 5% to the church, 5% to other charities, the churches would have, first of all, they'd be able to have free schools, free Catholic schools. They'd be able to support the Catholic schools. They could send any seminarian, pay for his education all the way. He could sponsor all kinds of missions. He could do unbelievable good with just a 5%. She goes on, I think the New Testament still tells us to tithe. Well, not exactly. Jesus says, if you have two coats, give to him who has none. Oh, Jesus, that's 50%. What are you doing here? 50%? Well, he did what he always does. He ramped up the Old Testament obligations. I cannot tell you, Dr. Ray, how much better my life has been since I began giving away 10%. It helps break the slavery to money and reminds me of where my security really rests. I don't want this to be a brag, just my comment and testimony. Dave Ramsey is very, very popular evangelical financial guru, financial guide. He's got wonderful stuff. He says the one way to break attachment to money is to give more of it away. It's true. I asked people, one fellow that I respect a lot, who was in the business of having to raise money for an institution, what is the number one reason that people, Catholics right now are the richest kind of group in our country. What is the number one reason why someone who has great, great means, multi-millions, will give $10,000 to something? Oh, Dr. Ray, you're being unfair. They give a lot to other places. Okay, I understand that. Most people who give to one give to many. Got that. But let's say that they're worth $22 million. And they give away $1 million a year. Now, that's a lot of money, not percentage-wise, but actual amount. $1 million. It's a ton. That leaves $21 million in assets. But, Dr. Ray, it's not necessarily liquid. All right, come on. We can justify ourselves all over the place. Why not? Why wouldn't they give, say, half of it? And you still have $10 million plus. He said this. The number one reason is security. Will I have enough? Will I have enough to give to my kids? Will I have enough when I get older? Will I have enough? All right, let me find this. Where is... Oh, these are all inbox. I need a kid here to help me with my phone. Dearest Dr. Ray, now that's the first time I've been called that. Dearest Dr. Ray, my husband passed away 2 years ago. Life is very difficult without him. I'm moving forward and taking care of things. But I feel like he walked out when he left that day in the catheter lab. In other words, they took a look at his arteries. It must not have been good. I am unable to say the word die. You can write it, but saying it out loud challenges her spirit. The finality of it crushes my spirit and breaks my heart. The finality of it is here. The finality of it is not what we believe as Christians. I think this gets to the crux of what was really eating at her. My question is, do you think that God gives a soul a chance to plead his case at the final judgment? What I think is not relevant here, dearest lady, what I think is what the church teaches. The church teaches that God is infinitely fair, infinitely merciful. So the person would not have to plead his case. God would look at his case and assess it and see his level of culpability and see whether a nice stay, if you will, that's counter to my opening monologue, in purgatory would be what is needed. My husband promised he would always be there for me. Why didn't he fight for me to stay? He was so needed here, and there is so much to take care of. I feel like he chose to leave and walk away. I think what she's alluding to is that apparently after he got the news on the shape of his heart, and I'm going to assume that he was in serious heart failure, like my father. My father's ejection fraction was 15%. That is major cardiac illness. That is basically limping along. And you get that low in heart function, you're near death. And maybe when he heard this after the heart catheterization results came back and they said, you're just this block, this block, this block, this block, and you could not tolerate surgery. Be too much. And now we don't know his age, okay? I totally trust in God, and I pray constantly. It is my faith that has sustained me. I feel guilty about losing him the way I did. And then the natural question is why? Why do you feel guilty? And here's where it comes. It's the old, looking back, I didn't do everything I could have done. She says, if I had only recognized the seriousness of his symptoms. How could you do that? You didn't know. You're not a doctor. And further, my guess would be that he was resistant. If he had these serious symptoms, if he's like a lot of guys, they poo-poo it. Or they say, yeah, I can handle it. And you're saying, well, I should have pushed him harder to get an intervention. Yeah? How would you have known that? During the Confiteor at Mass, instead of saying through my fault, I say all my fault, all my fault, all my most grievous fault. Oh, oh! First of all, the Confiteor is for sinfulness. It is not for miscalculations. It is not for a lack of foresight. You're saying that what you did was sinful. I doubt that there's any priest or theologian anywhere, dear lady, that would tell you what you did was sinful. How did you know? How could you know? Most people, even most medical people, oftentimes don't come to the severity of symptoms until they've eliminated a whole bunch of other stuff. They start out with it being a virus. Then they say, oh no, it might have been something here, and then they finally get the liver cancer. So, if you're blaming yourself or your husband, this is really heavy psychological advice I'm going to give you. You ready? Write it down. Don't. Nice to have you with me, Dr. Ray Guarendi. Program Here's the Doctor is in. Let's take a look and see what we got on this e-person. Our second oldest is 15. He is one of 12. That means you got 10 under 15. He's a freshman in high school. At a public school. He was at a parochial school pre-K through 8th. This year has been particularly difficult, as he has consistently become sneaky. This has been the case since middle school. Things like soda, candy, things reserved for treat time. However, it is bled into video games and phone. We allowed him to purchase an Xbox about a year ago, which he's had very little time with, as every time we give it back to him, he sits up all night or abuses it. It's currently gone indefinitely. Okay, I'll interrupt right there. Typically, when a parent says, "All right, we're trying to give this privilege," and that's usually a technological privilege. Those are the privileges that kids most want. Some type of technological thing. A game, computer time, smartphone. And when the parent finds that the child misuses it or abuses it, they typically wonder, how long do I take it? How long do I keep it away? Here's a rule of thumb I offer parents. How many times has this happened? If it's happened more than a couple of times, then it's no longer a matter of what offense leads to what deprivation of the privilege. That's not the question. The question is, should this youngster have this privilege? They're showing to you at this point they're not trustworthy. If allowed, they'll misuse it again. So this writer said he's currently is this Xbox that he plays all night. He sits up all night and abuses it. It's gone indefinitely. Yeah, I think a lot of it's got to come down to how he conducts himself in many other ways. If he's going to be sneaky, if he's going to steal stuff around the house, you can tell him. As long as you're doing this stuff, you're just pushing back the age when you'll get it. Now, Mom kind of had a brief line here at the beginning of the email where she said he's now in public high school. I cannot tell you how many parents will tell me after the kid has left a somewhat more protected environment of a parochial school or has been homeschooled and then moved into the public high school setting, that all kinds of social resistance problems have come to the fore. All kinds. Sneakiness, deception, surliness, resentment, that they look around them and see everything their peer group is allowed to have, allowed to do, with minimal parental supervision or limits, and they get bitter. They get resentful. They feel totally justified in saying, of course I can sneak to get this stuff because my parents are psycho unreasonable. That is such a common denominator. He has a cell phone, new this year, because of school. And he signed up on social media sites, which we said was not allowed. I think, again, this is reflecting what his peer group has, what his peer group is allowed to do. And by the way, just as an aside, there are legal movements now to limit social media to over age 16. I have parental restrictions on his phone, but I have to be diligent as he figured out how to get onto my account and change them. So you see what you're saying here, Mom. You're saying that no matter what I do to try to limit his exposure to this stuff, he's going to get around it. Now, obviously, he feels it is his perfect right to get around this stuff. So you got a decision to make. One, do you tell him these privileges will come on the basis of your trustworthiness and your good conduct? Now, obviously, you can put much more serious restrictions. You can get a smartphone. You can get something called Genesis. No, that's not right. There's a device you can get that you can put on all of the technological devices in your house. It covers all of them. And I know if I were doing a live call-in show, somebody would call and tell me what the name of it is. I forget. But you can search it. You can find it. And it essentially controls everything. You can decide when, where, how, what. However, if you're saying he gets this through school, do what we did. All communication came through my wife's phone as our homeschooled daughter up to age 8 went to school in the 9th grade, and we saw her spinning downward, and I pulled her out in the middle of the sophomore year. His grades are not the best. C's. And he is failing geometry. We've taken his phone, grounded him from hanging out with his friends, and it doesn't seem to make any difference at all. We don't see him trying to make positive changes. I can't know all the dynamics that are going on with him, how he views all this. It's not unusual that I see these kids who look... He may even look at the fact that he's got 11 brothers and sisters and thinking, this is really weird. Everybody at school has one or two. I've got 11. What kind of family is that? I don't know what his thinking is, but there's something that is pushing him to say, I have every right. It is my due to resist your rules. he says, okay, when we mention sending him to a private Catholic school, he responds with defiance. He says he'll flunk out on purpose. If you think that a private Catholic school is better for him, then you send him there. And if he flunks out, then you will deal with that as it happens. But you can't say that's a threat, that he's going to say, you can't make a judgment for my best interest because I'll sabotage your judgment. Now, Mom says this, I tend to err on the side of nagging. Yeah, Ma, that's all of that plotting and nagging and reasoning and reminding. No, it's not going to work. Makes it matter. I mean to help. As I keep up with his missing work, telling him daily. And this just makes him mad. Yeah, you're right. You can't just tell him daily. You're going to have to monitor it. And you're going to have to connect all of his privileges to his responsibilities. He isn't involved with drugs or bad friends. But I'm really struggling with this. Mom, go get my book, Standing Strong. Good Discipline Makes Great Teens. Might help you. Fries should be offered with pretty much everything. You go get a mortgage for your house. Mortgage officer says, yes, your mortgage was approved. Would you like fries with that? I think it would add a lot of social connectivity. We're delighted to give you your license, son, at age 16. Would you like fries with that? You're listening to Dr. Ray on The Doctor Is In. Would you like fries with that? This is E-Person Monday, where I take E-Persons, and I do it from my phone. I used to print them all out, and I got to admit, given my age and history, the feel of it in my hands makes it a little more comforting. But I use my phone. There's a risk in that. If a call comes in, a spam call, anything, it just blocks out the phone, and I can't see what I was just reading. Or if somebody texts me, out it goes. Take my chances. I have three kids. ages 5, boy, 3, boy, and 1, girl. I am a strict parent, but I struggle with the following scenario. I love this. These are like bullet point sentences. 3-year-old playing with toys. 1-year-old tries to play with 3-year-old, but inadvertently, and if I'm being honest, I'm not sure how inadvertent it is anymore. Well, okay. The 1-year-old isn't doing anything intentionally. He's too young. Okay. Yeah, he's attracted to whatever the 3-year-old's playing with. It's fascinating to him. He's curious. He's 1-year-old. He's going to go over there and he's going to grab stuff, or he's going to mess with it, or he's going to intrude. That's 1-year-old stuff. 1-year-old stuff. The 3-year-old gets upset and cries for me to remove his sister. I respond, if you don't want to play with your siblings, go play in your room. Now she's talking to the 3-year-old about this. This works for some time, but the 3-year-old still likes to remain close to me. His room's upstairs. He gets lonely and he comes back. Scenario repeats. Eventually he gets so fed up he hits his sister. Ooh. So I put him in timeout. All right, you can't hit a 1-year-old. That's right. I would definitely put him in timeout, and I would do this too. I would take whatever he's playing with away for at least a day or two. Absolutely. You can't hit a 1-year-old. Come on. The 1-year-old is not deliberately trying to make life difficult for the 3-year-old. The 1-year-old's just a 1-year-old curious. Now, I would suggest also to have a place to put the 1-year-old. If you got a pack and play or something like that, and you want the 1-year-old down there, or you just, what we did is when my wife was homeschooling, she had 12, 11, 10, 10, 9, 7, 4, 3, 2 baby. The 4-3-2-year-olds obviously were intrusive. They would certainly interrupt her attempts at homeschool. And this all took place down our basement. So I blocked off an area. It was probably about 10 foot by 12 foot down there. I blocked it off. Had a big gate, closed it. And we put toys in there and different things that they could play with and amuse themselves. And if anybody got rowdy, we pulled them out and stood them in the corner or sat them on the steps. But that was a period of time where they could not interfere with my wife's homeschooling. You might want to find some way to keep the 1-year-old from interfering relentlessly, by the way, with the 3-year-old. Or just simply set up some little place for the 3-year-old to play that the 1-year-old can't get in. You could do that. Set up some furniture or a gate, something. So the 3-year-old plays in there, 3-year-old still by you, but the 1-year-old can't get in there. I feel bad that the poor little guy can't catch a break playing. She's talking to the 3-year-old, I think. It must seem unfair to him that his play keeps getting disrupted. And yet he's the one winding up all the time in timeout. Well, yeah, you just got to keep his play from getting disrupted. So you find either something to do with a 1-year-old or something to do with a 3-year-old. The easier thing is to simply give the 3-year-old a little stretch someplace in the house where the 1-year-old can't get in. But I also can't spend my whole day restraining the 1-year-old, nor can I ignore the hitting. Yeah, you got to deal with the hitting. The hitting is more deliberate. The 1-year-old, you can't say, oh, the 1-year-old's deliberately intruding into the playtime. Nah. 1-year-old. My 5-year-old was a much more understanding boy and responded well for the most part to, he's little and just wants to play with you, be patient. Yeah, isn't that fascinating? The 5-year-old allowed the 3-year-old, when he was 1, to intrude, but the now 3-year-old, who was once 1 and intruded with his older brother, doesn't want to tolerate that. Help, please, Dr. Ray. This is a very specific scenario, and the internet is littered with gentle parenting. You know what she's referring to? I'm sure she's referring to all the ways that you need to reason with the 3-year-old, all the ways that you just do things and you explain. And you can distract a one-year-old. That's easy enough to do. The problem is she's going to have to keep distracting him. She'll distract him. Oh, I'm sorry, her. It's a one-year-old girl. She'll distract the little girl for 8 seconds, 10 seconds, 12 seconds. But what the three-year-old is doing is much more fascinating. So whatever she's going to do to distract, which is one of the gentle parenting suggestions, and it's a good suggestion for little ones, you do distract, but it doesn't last very long. So she's got to find something that can, in fact, separate the kids for some period of time. Then, other period of time, the three-year-old can go play upstairs, or the one-year-old can be in a pack and play, or the one-year-old can be kept from getting to the three-year-old. It's a very simple logistics, practical problem. I'm Dr. Ray.
Have you booked your spot for the Grand Getaway this year? It's held at the historic Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island from July 22nd to the 24th. Speakers include Scott and Kimberly Hahn, Father Josh Johnson, and Father John Ricardo. With daily mass, live taping of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomio, and dancing to the Grand Hotel Orchestra, it's hardly a surprise that there's just a few spots remaining for this very special event. Book this Ave Maria Radio trip now. Check the travel page on AveMariaRadio.net.
When an apology isn't good enough for someone, what do you do? I've made my share of mistakes over the years, and some worse than others. Some of my worst mistakes were because of my failure to do my homework, my research. There's power in the pen, and I've made mistakes by not properly vetting out articles that I edited before being published. I've never failed to apologize, or at least I don't think I have. But in cases when you do apologize and admit you're wrong, yet not all people offended will accept your apology, what do? You look into your own heart and conscience and see if you owe someone else forgiveness. It's what I did. At the end of the day, I'm harder on myself than anyone else could be on me. And for those who refuse to forgive, I let go and give it to God. Because in Ephesians it reads, "Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you." This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Dunha-Garmo, a communications evangelist.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. Thank you for joining me here. Dr. Ray Grandy, program Doctors In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Some 400 to 500 stations on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, as well as all the various ways you can stream it, you can hear it, you can app it, all those things. I said one time in an interview, I said, application. And the guy looked at me like, how old are you? Well, isn't that what it stands for? Eric, is that what it stands for? Application? No? You know? Oh, he doesn't know. See, he's too young. He's only heard app before his time. My daughter, just to show you how fast things have changed, now my son is 37, his sister's 35. When they were in college, they went to a local college as part of a high school program where you could earn college credits. So he was, I think, 17, she was 15, 16, somewhere there. That was 20 years ago. They used walkie-talkies to communicate because phones were just coming out. Just coming out. They'd been around a while, but I mean, in fact, we didn't give them one. At that point, it wasn't really all that necessary. Most of the kids didn't have one. My daughter, this is a quickie, so with about 5 minutes left, I'll jump on it, who is in the eighth grade, pleads for a new piece of clothing nearly every other day. I understand that this is partly her age talking, and I do like to see her dressed well. However, I simply can't afford to meet her tastes, nor would I want to if I could. How can I make her understand my limits? Oh, well, that's easy. That's really easy. Well, no, not the understanding part. That's not easy. That may not be possible. Your limits are easy. You don't do it. You want her to agree. Well, that's not going to happen. She may, again, she's heavily peer influenced, which is fascinating because we recognize peer influence on everything with a 13-year-old, but we don't recognize it in gender confusion. Pleads for a new piece of clothing. That's why she's nagging you. And what most parents do is they allow the nagging to go on. I would suggest this. What's her name? Taylor? Taylor. Not her name. I just made that up. Taylor, honey, don't nag me for clothes, please. Because every time you nag, it's just longer that I'll even consider getting you something new. She comes up and she says, it's been 5 days and I haven't said a word. You're right, honey. You're right, you haven't. But that's still not enough. And don't nag me, please, because I'll just push it out. Parents will say, oh, I get badgered, I get nagged. They just are relentless in hammering away at me. But I don't give in. I go, yeah, but do you like being badgered like that? My wife had a standard line, are you nagging? And that meant, stop now, or whatever you're nagging about is going to be an automatic no. Worked really well. Are you nagging was the signal to stop because she was going to act. How can I make her understand? See, that's part of raising kids. It's part of raising teenagers. They understand. If she were in my office and I would say to this little 13-year-old, do you know why your mother doesn't buy you something new all the time? Yeah, because I have plenty of clothes, and I know that I keep asking for new stuff, and we don't really have all that money, and she just doesn't want to do it. And so the little girl would lay out a litany of explanations. Now, Mom, who, after falling on the floor unconscious, I would get out the smelling salts, and I'd put them in front of her nose, she would get up, and I'd ask her, well, did you think she knew that? No, I didn't think she knew that. Why do you think she understands that? Well, I guess what I've been saying all this time has gotten through. And then I'll ask her this. Why do you think that that's not enough? If she understands why you're doing what you're doing, why do you think that's not enough to get her from nagging? Now, we live in a culture that says if you understand it, you're going to change it. That's not true at all. So I'll give Mom the answer. Mom, she understands perfectly well your position, your reasons. She doesn't agree. There's the difference. When somebody doesn't agree and they're intent on not agreeing, it's very hard to give enough reasons for them to acknowledge. If someone doesn't want to believe in God, now I know I'm really making a big leap here from the everyday clothing question to the infinite. If somebody doesn't believe in God, they don't want to believe in God. In their mind, it's just too much of a life-changing question. It would just alter too many things. They would no longer be their own ship's captain as they see it, even though they're running their ship into the ground. No matter what you give them for reasoning, logic, miracles, scientific evidence, system works, no matter what you give them, they will not pursue it. because at bottom, they don't agree. They don't want to do this. I don't want to is a very, very potent rationale. In my marriage book, I talked about something called resistance rationales, and it was my way of saying, this is why people resist doing even the simplest of good things for a marriage. In the end, the last chapter of the book, I said it was the ultimate resistance rationale. That was the chapter title. The ultimate resistance rationale. You know what it was? I don't want to. That was it. All the reasoning in the world doesn't make a difference if you don't want to. And this little girl, going back to Earth now, this little girl doesn't want to accept the reality of not getting something clothing-wise that she wishes at this point in her life. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Ray Guarendi. Walk with God. Hold your kids tight by the hand.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.